once that person has escalated to the point that they are in full crisis mode, their frontal lobe goes offline. They are no longer able to be reasoned with. It is very difficult to, as the expression goes, talk them down.
Welcome to Up My Nursing Game, the educational nursing podcast that uses expert interviews to address common nursing questions and pitfalls. I am your host, Annie Fulton. Listeners of this podcast can claim free CE credits for each episode through VCU Health. See the link in the show notes or at upmynursinggame.com. Welcome to today's episode, which is all about acute agitation, which can be a particularly stressful aspect of our jobs, let's be real, and a topic I've been looking forward to covering for a long time. It's one of those topics that isn't really covered in nursing school, but boy, do we see this in real life. So if you want to learn about helping patients who are going through acute psychosis, hyperactive delirium, or possibly drug intoxication or withdrawal, keep on listening. All right. Welcome to the episode. We have Dee Henderson, who is a nurse from Houston, Texas. She has a master's degree in nursing from the University of Texas at Austin and is a member of Sigma Theta Tau and is board certified in psychiatric and mental health nursing. She has over 40 years of experience in various areas of medicine and has spent over the last 16 years in psychiatric nursing, including direct care and teaching. She is still working currently in a teaching position. Welcome, Dee.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
And we also have Emma co-hosting today. Hello, Emma.
Hi, Annie. Hi, Dee.
Hi.
I'm excited about this. It's nice to be here.
Yeah. And Emma, if you could just tell us a little bit about your background in psychiatric nursing.
I am brand new to it as of a year ago. So I'm sort of just getting started. Knowing okay. What I'm doing thoroughly.
And before that, you were in a medical floor?
Medical, med-surg, yeah.
Okay.
And then before that, I was an ER tech, so, which you deal with quite a lot of psych patients in the ER. So
yes, you do.
It's like the other hub.
Right. It's the beginning of the funnel that will lead to.
This information, of course, is for nurses, but it is really for anyone, because at some point, every one of us is going to be in a situation, whether it's a family situation or out in a store, that we run into someone who is destabilizing and is escalating. And it would be useful to know how to interact with them.
Yeah. Yeah. And even someone who is not unstable, but just upset, I think some of the, like, the communication tips that we'll talk about today can be effective for really many aspects of life.
Absolutely.
So, Dee, how did you end up in your current specialty of psychiatric nursing and teaching?
Much like others, I started out in med-surg. And in fact, when students say they want to go into psych, I encourage them to get a medical surgical foundation. And it was actually I was working cardiology, and I was having to do telemetry on patients that were, say, recovering from an overdose as a suicide attempt, or perhaps they were detoxing from alcohol. And so they were on telemetry. And as I worked with these patients, I found that I was fascinated with their emotional needs as well as their physical. And over time, I really realized I wanted to focus on psychiatric care. But that being said, you don't forget the medical aspects of someone's care as well.
Absolutely. When you say that you were working in psychiatric nursing for the last 16 years, can you describe where you've been working?
I have worked in basically a gamut of psychiatric settings, in which I worked at a state hospital where people were in long-term specialized care where they had comorbidities of things like being blind or deaf, as well as a severe psychiatric illness. And then I also have worked in other settings, emergency rooms and so forth, but then also the high end of psychiatric care, private hospitals, in which people get the top-notch sort of diagnostics. And so they get the best of care there, and interventions such as TMS and ketamine treatments and so forth to help them. But I've gotten to see a wide range of the kinds of care that get delivered and where a lot of the needs are. And there is a great need.
Yeah. What is TMS?
Transcranial magnetic stimulation.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. It's a really good alternative when ECT is not effective, or someone doesn't want ECT, they already have, you know, say a seizure disorder, then that might complicate things. TMS is an interesting alternative. Also ketamine. I've seen people have severe prolonged depression, suicidality, that ketamine infusions under, of course, very highly controlled circumstances have been very effective in helping them break that cycle of depression and help them recover.
I did an episode recently about ketamine, and it seems to be like kind of an up and coming drug that we're starting to use again for many different indications. It's really fascinating.
And careful administration under controlled circumstances is the key.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I just wanted to start this discussion about acute agitation by kind of defining the terms that we'll be discussing. So Dee, I'll let you take it from here. Let's talk about what exactly acute agitation is.
It's defined in the literature as the feeling of irritability or severe restlessness with mental distress, excessive motor activity associated with a feeling of inner tension. And that tension really can manifest as self-injury or aggression toward other people.
Okay. And another concept we'll be talking about today is the crisis cycle.
Oh, yes. I love talking about the crisis cycle.
Yes, I think it's an excellent framework for understanding agitation. So, yeah, go ahead and introduce us to the crisis cycle.
Okay. Basically, when someone is in a calm baseline state, there really isn't any intervention needed. We're going about our daily business. But there is usually a trigger that changes that baseline state. And that can be anything from a bad phone call, getting a bill you can't pay, a psychotic episode, anything that destabilizes that baseline. And that's when the escalation starts to go up. And you want to intervene as early in that point as you can. Because as the person starts to escalate, it's a sort of self-feeding cycle that if, whether it's a clinician or a bystander, someone needs to intervene to help that person return to that baseline state by, if possible, removing the trigger. Sometimes it's something as simple as there's too much bright light, there's a loud noise, something can be very basic. That if you can remove the trigger or just a calming statement that you don't need to deal with that right now, we'll take care of it together. Whatever is the intervention that removes that trigger so that they don't continue to escalate. Because once that person has escalated to the point that they are in full crisis mode, their frontal lobe goes offline. They are no longer able to be reasoned with. It is very difficult to, as the expression goes, talk them down. Unfortunately, is the point at which some hospital settings or other clinical settings may use interventions such as physical holds, even mechanical restraints, such as arm restraints, we're used to the 5-point restraints, or are using medications to intervene to try to get that person to then go out of the crisis point and start to de-escalate. the scary part about it is once that person has hit that crisis point and you have to use those really invasive interventions, yes, it can break that particular crisis, but even up to 24 hours later, someone can have an adrenergic storm that can have serious medical consequences.
I would imagine that besides that 24-hour period of risk of the adrenergic storm, that there is a lifelong trauma associated with it.
Yes, absolutely. Those interventions are traumatic in themselves.
Yeah.
And so anytime, in fact, when people have done their training, if you're the person who they tie down, it's a frightening feeling, even for the 5 minutes that you're the one being tied down. So imagine someone being tied down for hours at a time. And yeah, it's a terrifying feeling, or secluded. So anytime you can avoid having to put someone in seclusion or restraints, or even give them the classic cocktails of medications, then it's a better intervention. Mm-hmm. So it's focus on that early part of the crisis cycle, and there will be a better outcome for everyone.
Yeah. The further along the crisis cycle you are, the less options you have in terms of
absolutely
managing it.
Yes, absolutely.
Like so much of nursing, it's about early recognition.
Yes.
Right.
And that, you know, that would be the same if it were pain. You know, you want to get somebody when their pain is in the low end of the scale rather than when they're in full blown pain. Like we say, you'd rather get ahead of the pain than chase the pain. The same is true of crisis.
Well, because crisis is emotional pain, right?
Exactly. It is.
I love that. I love that, Emma. So obviously this podcast is not exclusively geared towards psychiatric nurses, but as medical nurses on, you know, medical, surgical, emergency, critical care floors, we're also seeing acute agitation, but from a different etiology. Can you talk about the, you know, more metabolic causes of acute agitation as opposed to, say, like the psychiatric ones?
Of course, anything that's medical can contribute to that. Drug intoxication, of course, is a big one. Withdrawal from like alcohol intoxication, high fevers due to things like encephalitis. I've seen some pretty destabilized people with that. Delirium from things we see anytime you see an older woman, the first thing you think of is let's do a urine analysis and see if she has a bad UTI, because that symptoms of fear delirium has occurred with a bad UTI.
Other things like brain disease, brain injury, tumors on people's, you know, brain is.
Absolutely. Even electrolyte imbalances, endocrine imbalances, those things also can be metabolic for.
Yeah. Low blood sugar.
Low blood sugar, high blood sugar. And those are, of course, things that as nurses, the first thing you do is assess. And so you try to, if someone is destabilized, you try to eliminate things that can be readily corrected. And then, you know, depending on their history, if you have no history, you try to eliminate the medical. And then if they do have a history, you want to address that.
Yeah. This is just anecdotal, but in my experience in nursing, I've seen a lot of agitation from use of narcotics in narcotic naive patients, especially elderly, if they're like receiving like post-surgical pain medication and they're in so much pain, you feel like, you know, you want to give them some relief, you give them morphine, and then it just, you know, sets them off into this severe agitation. So we've talked about kind of defining acute agitations, the different etiologies involved. So let's talk about, you know, interventions, nursing interventions, and what we can do for these patients. And I think it makes sense to talk about non-pharmacologic interventions first, as this is kind of where you're earlier on in the crisis cycle.
Right. That is the good news, is that any altered mental status can be treated and hopefully stabilized. I kind of had the non-pharmacological absolutely first. Sometimes changing just the temperature of the room, the level of lighting, basically looking at all those Maslow's lower hierarchy needs of, I've had patients who were absolutely flipping out in the emergency room. And the big question is, what do you need? And a lot of times what they need is that they're hungry.
Yeah, absolutely. 100% of my ER experience was like, can we just feed this person? Like,
yes.
Yes. And sometimes it takes 4 snacks to get them fed. But if you can feed them, if they're thirsty, if they're cold, you get them a nice warm blanket. You know, sometimes meeting those very basic needs are all you need to prevent that person from escalating. So addressing those things first, of course, I think is the first part of that.
I was just speaking with a friend of mine who works in emergency, and he said he had a patient in on a 5150 who wouldn't calm down because her dogs were stuck in her car.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, like, how relatable that was. Like, I would be very agitated too if my dogs were stuck in my car too.
So. Absolutely. In fact, that has come up in the emergency room where someone was very upset because their dog was home alone. And so we were able to work it out that someone, a friend was able to go over and check on the dog and feed the dog and so forth. And then you can turn back to the patient and say, now let's take care of you.
Mm. Yeah,
because then they have their focus. But, you know, if their ideas are set outside of the clinical setting, you're not going to keep their attention.
I'm thinking about this, the instances of 5150s and someone who's, you know, severely agitated. Mm-hmm. Does consent become an issue in that case if you're doing something like doing an IM administration of antipsychotic, or is that if once you're in a 5150, they lose that right?
Once you're in that situation, and it's called different things in different states, once the patient is in such a state that legal remedies are necessary and there is a warrant, there is where the patient is being under commitment, then when there is emergency care needed, then yes, they can't refuse the medication that they're court ordered. And that's when emergency medications for the sake of the patient and the safety of the patient and the safety of others becomes involved. And that's when, yeah, the 10-250 and other classic cocktails are like Haldol, Ativan, Benadryl, Risperdal, Seroquel, whichever the medications are ordered, those can be administered without consent because you've hit a different level
of, I see,
where you are in care. I mean, we've all done the breathing techniques. Have a patient having a panic attack. The first thing you do is get their focus and talk to them about breathing. I've literally had patients who are panicking so much that I had them put their hand on my shoulder and just breathe with me to get them to physically calm down.
Some of the environmental interventions, and let's talk about communication too, like some techniques, if you have any like pearls you can share with us.
Absolutely, because we talked about establishing trust. If you can establish trust with a patient, establish a rapport. And sometimes that can be something as simple as noticing that they have a shirt with a cat or a dog on the shirt and engaging them about, you know, what's important to them. Oh, do you like cats? Do you like dogs? Whatever. Get some sort of basic human interaction set up so that you establish trust. And then once you've done that, you really want to make them feel heard. A lot of patients feel like nurses and doctors don't hear them, don't see them, don't really recognize them as a human being, and are just treating them, you know, with, as a case rather than as a person. So just knowing that they are being heard, that they're being seen, and sometimes it's something as simple as when they say nobody cares and your response is, I care. I care about you and I want to see you get better. Sometimes it's something as simple as that can make them feel connected to another person, and that has a grounding effect that is very therapeutic and opens the door for you to then offer them medications, for you to engage them in group therapy or whatever the other interventions are.
Are you a nurse who wants to be on their A game when responding to emergencies? The thought of being unprepared or drawing a blank when a patient is crashing is a real fear for many nurses. That's why the Rapid Response and Rescue course was created, to empower nurses with the knowledge and confidence to respond to any emergency. This one-hour online course is taught by recent guest Sarah Lorenzini. I love Sarah because she is such a great storyteller, and who doesn't love a good medical story? Seriously, it's the best way to learn. So, in this course, Sarah teaches rapid assessment and crisis management skills so that you can manage rapid responses effectively. It is worth one contact hour of continuing education credit. Go to rapidresponseandrescue.com in the show notes and use the promo code UPMYGAME10 to get $10 off. Again, it's rapidresponseandrescue.com.
Well, you've brought up an important intervention, which is one of the things you can do so you can avoid going into those restraint seclusion things is distraction. If you can give someone, you know, music, or you can set up a movie that is distracting for them to watch, or offer them a puzzle. I've had schizophrenics that love doing jigsaw puzzles. If you can get them to engage in an activity outside of themselves, you know, that will be therapeutic and will be, you know, hopefully stabilizing if they're upset. You remind them, in fact, safety plans have become something that is not a contract that I will not hurt myself, but rather what things can you do positively to help yourself? You know, can you go read a book? Can you go call a friend? Can you go work on a jigsaw puzzle? Those things are set up at the initial assessment so that as the patient is in treatment or you're interacting with someone, you can redirect them and say, well, you know, you seem really upset. Do you want to talk about that? Or do you want to get your music going? You offer them choices. And even just giving them a choice between apple juice and orange juice gives them some empowerment. Mm-hmm. And that's helpful.
Yeah. That's helpful. Some distraction techniques I've tried in the past are pencil and paper, and maybe give them a prompt of something to write about. I saw a nurse recently says to agitate a patient, write down everything that's pissing you off right now. And he's like, I will. And folding, like giving them towels and sheets or pillowcases, like, can you fold these for me? Sorry, I'm running a little, you know, behind here. Can you just help me like fold these?
Yeah. I think in general care, trauma-informed care is so important because you may see someone in the emergency room that has been brought in there for being in a motor vehicle accident, and you're assessing them, but you know, you want to put the leads on their chest and you pull up their gown, for especially for a woman, you know, to show her bare chest. And if you're insensitive to the fact that she may have been sexually assaulted at some point, and so you may be re-traumatizing her severely. So it's important to do a good quick assessment of, you know, anything that might be traumatizing for that patient before you just go ahead with an intervention. That goes back to the whole thing about talking your way through what you're doing, talking your way through what you're doing for someone so that they understand the process. And at that point, they may be more readily able to tell you if something would be upsetting and how you could work with them to get done what you need to get done to help them, but also not re-traumatize them.
I think about that a lot when I am like straight cathing or, you know, anything involving, you know, genitals.
Absolutely.
That, yeah, I think this is a great reminder to really talk through what you're doing to them and why. But I always have at the back of my head, like, I don't know how upsetting this is going to be for the person.
Yeah, it may be that they've had a sexual assault, or it may be that they've just had recurrent UTIs and getting catheterized is traumatizing just because of how things go with that. It's embarrassing. It's uncomfortable. You know, compassion is one of the other big C's along with caring. You want to be compassionate because that's why we're in the career, is that we do care about people. And so we use our compassion to inform how would we feel being in that situation and try to have that perspective and be thoughtful about how we're delivering the care.
Dee, you're so kind and thoughtful that I've had a thought recently when I feel like I'm getting worked up at work. I'm like, I need just a little Dee in my pocket to hold out. Because you wrote in the notes that you've been cussed out, you've been assaulted. It sounds like you've been through all of that. And I'm like, man, and she's still so nice, you know? And I think it also goes to show that, like, how much you can't take it personally. Like, if it happened to you, then it could happen to anyone.
Oh, it does happen to everyone at some point as a nurse. I mean, even if you're working in med-surg, at some point you're going to have a patient swing at you.
Yeah. Or say, like, really not nice things. Learn to not take it personally. I mean,
well, in fact, I tell nursing students, it can't be personal because they don't know you. How can it be personal if they don't really know you?
Exactly. Okay. So let's continue further along the crisis cycle here and talk about some of the pharmacologic interventions as well as other methods like restraints and seclusion.
Most nurses in psych know the classic cocktail of Haldol, Ativan, and Benadryl, 10-250, of course, modified depending on the patient. Other interventions often are Cyprexidis or the Risperdal MTABs, things that are quick acting. And sometimes if you can get a patient to take an oral medication, and again, trying to empower them by saying, okay, you're really not doing well right now. We need to offer you either a pill or an injection. Some people call it a shot to help you settle down. So which would you like to use? And some people say the shot.
Absolutely.
Some people prefer that because they know it acts, especially someone who's a frequent person in the system. They may know that that acts very quickly and they may ask for the injection. But some people don't, you know, they have a fear of needles. That's a whole thing. Absolutely. For the general population, doesn't like needles. So sometimes they'll prefer the oral medication, the quick-acting sublingual medications. So you offer them, again, and trying to empower them for that choice. But if they are not in a position where you can offer them a choice, then usually you go ahead with put them in a physical hold and give them the injection. And then, of course, put them on a one-to-one observation until they can be in a condition in which you can engage with them again.
Let's talk about this classic cocktail for our listeners who aren't familiar with it. And I'm actually one of those.
Oh, okay.
I've heard of it. I've heard it called like B52, but I've never seen it being used. So who is this indicated for?
It would be indicated for, and Emma, you can jump in, you know, with this as well. It's indicated for anyone who is in that peak of the crisis cycle to where they have basically emotional tunnel vision. They are not able to reason. They are not able to self-calm. They're not able to accept redirection. This is someone where you've tried all the other de-escalation techniques and none of them are working, perhaps because they're in a psychotic episode. They're in an extreme manic episode because of destabilized bipolar. or other situation that has put them in that state to which no other intervention will work other than medical. And that's when you intervene with the Haldol, which is an, just utilizing, say that one. The Haldol is an antipsychotic, and you're addressing the destabilized mental state for that. The Ativan, of course, is anxiolytic. So you're trying to help them calm down as far as their level of anxiety. And then the Benadryl is soporific, but it does have a calming effect in its interaction with those other two medications. And so the typical combination of an antipsychotic and an anxiolytic and some sort of soporific will help the person settle down. And sometimes they go on to sleep. And then once they've had a restful period, then they're better able to be engaged in therapeutic interactions.
So let's say I have a patient who's, you know, at the peak of this crisis cycle, we give them this cocktail. What should I expect to happen next?
Typically, it takes, even with the IM, of course, it's like any other IM, it takes a little while for it to settle in. And it depends on the level of agitation of the patient. Some patients will have a pretty rapid onset of the effects of the medication, and you'll be able to release them from restraint or seclusion pretty quickly. Other patients have to be in seclusion or in a physical hold for some period of time, or you may have to go ahead and put them in the mechanical restraints for to give time for the medication
to take effect.
Yeah, but of course, the key element with any kind of restraint, be it mechanical or physical, is as soon as you can reasonably take them out of the restraint, you do. Because the sooner you take them out, the less traumatizing that intervention is.
So maybe the hope is that once this kicks in, and are you saying about maybe like 5 minutes until it becomes effective? Like, when do you start seeing its benefits?
Again, it really depends on their metabolic state, but 5-10 minutes, sometimes it takes longer, unfortunately. But once they are in restraints, they are on a one-to-one staffing because they have to be observed at all times. You don't want them to be at risk for any kind of positional asphyxiation. Of course, they're never in a prone position. You want to make sure that they are breathing correctly and safely. They're oxygenating all right. You want to make sure that they are not in pulling on the restraints in such a way as to cause physical damage. They need to be observed constantly so that at the point where the observer and the nurse is constantly checking in, usually the one-to-one is one of the techs, but the nurse is checking in Q15 and charting on this. And so there are very strict measures. I know in Texas, there are extremely strict measures for the charting on a patient who is under any kind of restraint. And that's important so that no harm comes to the patient while we're trying to help.
So is the hope then that once the medication takes effect, that you're able to release them from restraints?
Yes. And in fact, if they fall asleep, you release them. If they seem to be calming down and you can speak to them so that they seem to be more cognitively aware again, then you release them. You release them at the earliest point that you safely can. And not to say that there haven't been occasions where someone was put back into restraints, but in general, it's a short-term intervention, we hope.
Right. What is this cocktail we're talking about, the Haldol, Ativan, Benadryl? Who is this contraindicated for?
It would definitely be contraindicated for anyone that has sensitivities to this. And certainly Haldol, being one of the older antipsychotics, can have risk for neuroleptic malignant syndrome. So you want to, of course, avoid that, and that's another reason to be monitoring this patient closely so that you notice that they don't develop any of the neuroleptic malignant syndrome symptoms, spiking of fever, the increased agitation, and so forth. Yeah, any time you're concerned about their interactions with these medications, then some of the newer ones might be a good place to start. And then if need be, go to the injection.
In the ER, we did give B52 sometimes. We also just give straight up Haldol IM. And on the psych ward that I'm working in now, we mostly give olanzapine or Zyprexa.
How effective are you finding just monotherapy of olanzapine or Haldol as compared to the cocktail?
Well, so I haven't seen a lot of the cocktail given, so I don't know exactly, but it generally seems pretty effective. I don't think we've ever, I know like for a fact that we use the least, we have the least per capita use of physical or mechanical restraints as anywhere in the hospital in the psych unit. And partly that's because, at least my experience in the med-surg has been that doctors are reluctant to give you IM, you know, Zyprexa. They are scared about giving Haldol. They don't want to like deal with the psych meds, so they don't give you those options. So when someone's in that distress, like tunnel vision state, you can't say, I'll give you this or this. You can just say, I'm going to work with you.
Emma, you bring up a very important point, which is while I was still working on cardiology, I noticed that doctors tend to stay in their lane of specialty. And when they aren't familiar with these medications, when it's not the psych ER, it's the regular ER, or if they're on the floor for another reason, renal, cardiology, whatever. The doctors, I have had doctors say when I've had the admitting medications, well, this patient has been on Zoloft and they've been on Zyprexa and so forth. Well, they can deal without those for a few days probably. And that shows basically a lack of understanding about psychiatric medications. But also, you know, it's that it keeps the nurse in a position where you don't have good options for those interventions. And I think more education to doctors in general and nurse practitioners and other people who are clinicians that don't typically deal with psychiatric medications. Some education there is helpful so that they do feel more comfortable offering a Zyprexa, either if not IM, at least the Zydis, or the Risperdal MTAB, that you're able to use those as an option. We don't ever have particularly standing orders anymore in psychiatric care. And so having an educated nurse who can go through the SBAR with that doctor and say, here's my situation. And typically, if you give that doctor a good alternative for an intervention, say, this is what, you know, every nurse knows. If you go through the SBAR and you say, this is what I need to address the situation, if it seems reasonable, they will go along with it. And you've been able then to offer your patient something that will truly be helpful in that situation.
That's what I'm hoping listeners will feel empowered to do at the end of this episode is, you know, if you have a patient, you know, at the peak crisis cycle here, and say for most of my listeners who are not psychiatric nurses and they're not communicating with psychiatrists, they're communicating with doctors who don't have perhaps this level of familiarity to be able to say, can we try this? That's why I'm very excited to talk about, like, you know, these kind of pharmacologic interventions here. Because honestly, right now, when I have an acutely agitated patient, I don't really know what to ask for. I know, like, I'm going to steer away from benzos as it often has a paradoxical effect. But beyond that, you know, this is a really helpful discussion for me to know, like, what should be reaching for that's safe and effective. And that brings up one point I have is that I know a lot of psychiatric medications have prolonged
QT. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And perhaps you could talk about which medications do this and when you should be considering that, like, what perhaps like your cardiac patients, you should be, you know, especially careful of these medications?
Well, you know, just to off the top of my head, say Seroquel. Seroquel is great for breaking a manic episode if there's a destabilized bipolar. But if someone is on Seroquel long-term, especially if it's in combination with other medications, that can prolong the QT interval. And so that's why it's good to have a 12 lead if you can do it, to look at the QTC. And if it is getting higher up in the, you know, toward 500, certainly over 450, then you can advise the doctor that this, you see this happening. And of course, any irregularities, any arrhythmias that you notice, you want to, of course, report that to the doctor quickly. But it sometimes people can live for a very long time without it being an acute problem cardiac-wise, because they do need these medications to keep their mood stabilized, particularly in bipolar patients. And then, you know, they can live with that safely, but it does require frequent monitoring so that they check in with their primary care or cardiologist that they're not having these deleterious effects on their cardiac status.
Please correct me if I'm wrong, because obviously I'm new here, but I would say those QTC prolongation is mostly because of the time length you're on the drug, right? It's not like I'm hitting someone with olanzapine, I am 10 milligrams, it's going to prolong the QTC and they're going to go into trisods today. You know, like it's
right.
Well, hopefully it's not like trisods. Right. Or anything, right? So it's not going to, I mean, except if they're like a serious cardiac patient with severe heart issues, right? But then you're like all sorts of worried. When I'm giving, like when we're giving shots like that, in the unit, it's because a person is like bashing their head against the wall, right?
Right.
And they won't stop. So the sort of priorities are not, you know, if they got on this medication seriously and they take it for years, they may prolong their QTC versus my patient is like acutely trying to injure themselves. And the only way to break this besides putting them in 4 points is giving them the shot.
I'm glad you brought that up. But it's not like, you know, while they're at this peak of the crisis cycle, you're like, sit down and do a 12 lead so we can assess whether we're going to give you olanzapine. Okay, so that's really helpful, Emma. So you're saying that it's more of this like long-term therapy in which you're concerned about getting for the QTC prolongation.
Being on psych meds is really hard. They make you gain weight. They lower your sex drive. They keep you remembering orgasms. They give you metabolic syndrome. They cause tremors. They cause tardive dyskinesia. You know, like all these things long-term are very, very hard about keeping on these meds. But I'm not worried about that in the context of a crisis.
Yeah, in the context of an acute agitation, it's sort of like the ABCs and you're doing compressions on someone's chest. You're not worried about breaking their ribs. You're worried about keeping their heart pumping. So in the situation about the prolonged QTC, in that situation, yeah, the focus is on stabilizing the patient in the acute situation rather than about what their cardiac situation is. And I agree with Emma that generally you'll see the prolonged QTC in someone who has been on medications for quite a while. And then, you know, you want to make sure it's more of a follow-up issue.
Oh, so that's really helpful for me to understand that you don't necessarily need to be keeping that aspect of the medication in mind when you're talking about like a one-time use.
No, I mean, if you have a history on someone and they have this, that may inform which medications the doctor wants to use to try to help with the crisis situation if they have a history. But if you don't, then you utilize what means you have.
Okay, so let's quickly like do a rundown here. So we talked about the B52 cocktail. We talked about, Emma, you said you're giving olanzapine, and that's an antipsychotic, correct?
It's a mood stabilizer, yeah. But like a real heavy hitting mood stabilizer. It's not like lithium. It's like, I don't really know how to describe it, but it's like a strong arm mood stabilizer. It's like your mood's going to stabilize now rather than give it a little bit of time.
Along that same vein, let's talk about restraints in seclusion. And the more I researched this, the more it became, I don't like using restraints, just like purely from my experience, I find restraints make things worse. And I'm always the nurse that is taking off restraints and everyone's getting pissed off at me, like, don't do that. I'm like, but let's just try, you know? So the more I find out about restraints, the more fearful I become of them. So yeah, I'm interested to hear what you two have to say about restraints and why they are so dangerous for a patient, both like psychologically and medically.
Honestly, I've never seen a patient put in restraints because they were aggressive against nurses. I've only seen it done because they were self-harming in a way and they were not able to be distracted, redirected, given medication, you know. Oh, you go through all the other steps that you could, you know. Is there anyone that they trust who can talk to them? Is there like anything that we can do to take them away from this? You know, it's like you get into a tunnel that's just fueled by all this distress and pain, and you can't get anywhere else, but I'm hurting myself. And so if there's any way to get them out of that tunnel, you know, we try everything. And then, you know, and then usually it's in restraints because we've given them an IM and we need 15 minutes or 30 minutes before they...
Unfortunately, I've seen the other side quite a bit where they were, if they weren't, sometimes they attack staff, but they also attack other patients. Yeah, I recently saw someone who another patient was just sitting, back to you, catatonic, sitting at a patient table, and another patient came up from behind him, obviously in a psychotic episode, and just hauled off and slugged the poor patient. And so immediately staff rushed in, put him in a physical hold, redirected him into one of the seclusion rooms. And unfortunately, that was what needed to happen. The nurse went, got emergency medications, because this patient was being extremely violent to the point that all the other de-escalation techniques would not be a logical intervention. So at that point, you need to act it is an emergent situation. And so you do have to use emergency medications. And that varies depending on what the doctor is comfortable with, but and what your facility is comfortable with. But at that point, you do utilize those emergency medications and put the patient in a situation where they're in either seclusion, which is better than putting them in physical restraints, tying them down. But even that is traumatic. And the physical restraints, unfortunately, are the worst. And so the rule is to use the least restrictive measure possible. And that's what Emma's speaking to. And I applaud the record that they have where she is. And I actually have seen a better record of that in the private care facilities, because they have more resources. And then when you have a patient who's brought in by the constables and they're in handcuffs and they're being handcuffed to the bench where you are, you're starting at a much tougher level of what you're dealing with than if someone is voluntarily admitted to a facility.
Yeah. They're further along the crisis cycle.
They're in the peak of the crisis cycle when you get them. And so that's a point where you do as much of an assessment as you can for their physical well-being. And then, yes, it may require some medical intervention with psychiatric meds before you can proceed with the rest of the assessment.
Can you describe why, medically speaking, there are poor outcomes when restraints are used? Like, what is the physical harm?
Yeah, we talked a little bit at the beginning about the adrenergic response. You get catecholamines running rampant in your system. Person is already really ramped up. Their systolic shoots up. They've got adrenaline going. And that creates all the fight or flight response in the person physically. And of course, then that is, they get tachycardic. And if they have some underlying cardiac arrhythmia, that can start triggering arrhythmias that become more dangerous. So yeah, physically, the trauma of the event itself can then prolong that period of fight, flight, and they can be, you know, cause themselves physical harm just in the situation from the intervention.
Sounds like it's particularly dangerous for patients who have pre-existing cardiac disease.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Or who have pre-existing trauma.
Yes, absolutely. And we're back to trauma-informed care. If someone has been the victim of sexual assault, holding them down and doing things to them is going to be extremely traumatic.
I was reading about the risk of rhabdomyolysis in patients who are severely agitated. Have you ever experienced anything like this?
Only in patients that are sort of predisposed to that, where they have a fairly lean body mass, so that when their body starts to metabolize, it can start metabolizing their body proteins and maybe put them into rhabdo. It's not something I see a lot in the acute, that I've seen a lot in the acute setting. I've seen it in cardiac a lot, but not so much in, you know, in general medical settings, but that really hadn't been a focus.
Yeah. I mean, like rhabdo is often like it's delayed. So it would be kind of the fallout of being in, you know, restraints in that storm.
I can see that happening. Absolutely. I can see that happening.
When I'm providing, you know, postmortem care to a patient and going through like, you know, the checklist that we have at the hospital, one question that always comes up is, was the patient in restraints within the previous 24 hours? And it's been really enlightening to speak with you, Dee, about why that question is even on there. Because there is so much, like there's so many, you know, risks involved with putting a patient in restraints that last up to, you know, 24 hours, even after they're released.
Right. Yeah. I mean, even breathing difficulties can be an after effect, because if they've been trained in one position, they can have neuromuscular problems. If someone has underlying sciatic nerve problems, just being compressed in one position on the bed and cause medical problems. So it's real based on what their condition is when they're coming in. And, you know, you have to think about those things, positional check the restraints to make sure that they're not causing injury to the person, whether it's a physical restraint or a mechanical, that is not causing them physical damage as you're doing it. And then afterwards, they could have the after effects of that positional restraint for sure.
Yeah, that's a part of our intake where we go over what physical or psychological history would make this person a poor choice to be in restraints. And so you note things like, you know, they have a sexual trauma history, or like they have a rotator cuff injury, you know, so like we have to figure out a way to restrain them looking all the way downfield, like if this person gets into this point perspective, how can we protect their body and contain their emotional response? You know,
Emmy, you hit it right the nail on the head, that you want to make sure if they do have an injury history, that you don't further traumatize that area. That, yeah, if you have to put them in a hold or whatever, that you don't. In fact, anytime someone is trained to put someone in a hold, the emphasis is on preventing the person from harming themselves or someone else while not causing any kind of pain or injury to them. Unfortunately, many years ago, there were almost like wrestling holds that were allowed that used pain to redirect the patient. It's that actually, in fact, I believe some, you know, maybe perhaps military or police training would allow for some pain to interfere with that process. I don't know. I don't take that training. But I know in psychiatric care, the emphasis is on keeping the patient safe, keeping others safe, while not causing injury. or pain, including, you know, putting someone, bending someone in such a way that it causes them pain, even if they don't have a predisposing injury. You want to make sure that you don't injure them further, for sure.
What would you like listeners to take away from this discussion? So maybe some key points here.
The thing that I'd like them to take away is that every nurse is a psychiatric nurse, that every nurse will encounter at some point, in fact, general people will encounter someone at some point who is upset and they might be able to help in that situation. But nurses definitely will encounter patients no matter what service they're on, whether it's inpatient or it's or out in public somewhere. They're going to encounter someone who is having a crisis, is starting to get upset, and they can intervene in such a way that perhaps they can avert a dangerous situation to themselves, to others, to that patient or to that person, and save a situation from becoming really drastic. You don't want to have someone injured in that situation. I would hope that nurses would want to do a little more research on their own so that they do know which medications they might want to ask for if they're not in a psychiatric situation or if they are. And that way, and also just, you know, utilize podcasts like this or other educational media that can tell them things that they can do to calm the situation, including not asking someone to calm down. The one thing you don't want to say is calm down. Another thing you don't say is, why are you doing this? Because sometimes they really, really don't know. And that's what you need to help them figure out. But the key question to ask is, what do you need? And if you ask, what do you need, or how can I help you? Sometimes they will have an answer that you can then utilize to be helpful. And I would hope that nurses would try to see it as a situation where agitation is something that they can be helpful with and that they do not have to be in a situation where they end up injured or see the patient injured, that there are things that can be done to intervene that will mitigate the situation in a productive way for everyone.
I really like that. There's some great pearls that you've given us today. And Dee, you're such a treasure to nursing. And I've said this to you before, and I'll say it again, but I mean, the wisdom that you've amassed over these four decades in nursing is something that I'm worried that we won't have in the future, as there seems to be this mass exodus in nursing. And I'm just so honored to have the privilege of speaking with you today and to be able to glean as much as I can from you in listening and getting all these practice-changing pearls of wisdom. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. And I do hope that if nurses will inform themselves about different areas that perhaps they're not as comfortable with, that then they will be more comfortable and more able to stay in nursing, because a lot of time people leave nursing because of an unpleasant situation. And if they're more comfortable in dealing with agitation, perhaps they will be able to safely navigate their way through many decades of being nurses and not feel like they need to leave, because we certainly do need more nurses. That's why I'm teaching nursing students, and we definitely need more nurses coming in. I'm glad to see young people like you and Emma in the profession, because that's what we need.
I love that. Thank you so much, Dee.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for the privilege of being on your program.
All right, that's all for today. Keep sharing this podcast with your nursing friends and colleagues. It would really mean the world to me. Claim your free CE credit, and until next time, I hope that you have upped your nursing game.